Welcome to Few and Far Between, conversations about rare disease research. I'm your host, Chris O'Brien. On today's podcast, Dr. Mark Gass, Associate Director of Program Development at BioRossi, will be talking with Kelly Franchetti, SVP and Global Head of Patient Insights and Strategy at Y-Prime. Thanks for hosting this episode, Mark. Tell us a little bit about the conversation with Kelly.
Hi, Chris, and thank you so much for having me host this episode. It will be my pleasure to give you some insight here on Kelly and my conversation with her. Kelly is a highly experienced registered nurse who continues to spend time very closely with patients. She has more than 25 years of experience in patient advocacy at a global scale, and her focus is to bridge the gap between patients and pharma biotech companies to help move the industry forward and get treatment to patients and families in need. As a mother of a child with rare disease, Kelly also had to pave her own path on understanding and navigating rare disease over 20 years ago. That led her to understand the hardships and the needs of patients with rare disease and their families and caregivers. Now she dedicates her life to support others in the same situation that she experienced.
It's amazing how much we see this theme of people who have direct experience with rare disease and then shift or adjust their careers to focus on rare disease. Kelly's a great example of this. I'm sure that this combination of her personal and professional experiences has given her a unique perspective into what the patient journey looks like from diagnosis or even into diagnosis, and then ultimately into participation in clinical trials and hopefully positive results. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. Kelly has a very unique and really interesting story. From her perspective, you'll see that she understands the needs from the patient and the caregiver, and also from drug developing pharma industry. Through advocacy, she's developed processes and methodologies to obtain robust insights that positively affect protocol development, patient recruitment and retention strategies, and that bridges that gap between the people developing the therapies and the patients. I'm sure that the audience will feel Kelly's passion through our conversation, and I invite all listeners to reach out to her with any questions that they may have.
That's great, Mark. I'm sure the listeners are going to enjoy this episode. So without further delay, let's get into your discussion with Kelly right now.
Welcome, everyone, to a new episode of Few and Far Between, conversations about rare disease research. Today, I'm honored to have a guest that has dedicated her life to rare disease research. She is the Senior Vice President and Global Head of Patient Insights and Strategy at Y-Prime. I'm very excited about this conversation because she brings not only a professional view into rare disease, but also a personal experience into rare disease. It's my honor to present to everyone and introduce everyone to Kelly Franchetti. Hi, Kelly. Welcome to our podcast.
Hi. Good afternoon. Thank you.
How are you? How is it going?
Good. Going well here. Nice weather. So that's a plus. Don't hear that often anymore.
Amazing. As I said, I think the audience is going to enjoy this conversation very much because I know that there is a lot of people that are within our industry, but also a lot of people that are interested from the patient perspective, from the family perspective, from the caregiver perspective. And I think you bring an amazing mix of both to the table. So I'm really excited for our conversation today. I thought it would be interesting to start telling the audience a little bit about you, who you are, what's your background, what do you do in your current role as Global Head of Patient Insights and Strategy at Y-Prime?
Sure. So I think first and foremost, I'm a mom. My background is in nursing. I've been a nurse for over 25 years. So I think from that perspective, I've always been a patient advocate. I think it's something that's always been at my heart. But when my son was born, he was born with a rare condition. It wasn't diagnosed until he was approximately like 11 months old. I really didn't at that time, even being a nurse and being in a, you know, really large research hospital, still didn't know a whole lot about rare disease at all. Not something that had ever kind of run in our families or anything that we were, you know, expecting, like many families of rare disease out there. So he was diagnosed at 11 months old, and I just had to kind of learn to navigate the medical system, the pharmaceutical side of things, all the different doctors, all of those different things that came into it. And I remember thinking back then, what do people do that don't have a medical background. You know, how are they finding out information and what does this look like? And I started, you know, really looking into advocacy and found that there was, and, you know, this is my son who was diagnosed at 11 months old, literally will be 26 in 2 weeks. So it was a long time ago. And there wasn't a lot of advocacy out there. I mean, there was things out there for some of those bigger chronic conditions and things like that, but nothing that I could find that really spoke to these really small little niche areas in disease states. And so I just kind of set off on a mission to not only find out as much as I could, but find out about how I could advocate for him. And then after that, help others within those disease areas. And it just so happened directly after that, my nephew was born. He will be 21 in a few weeks. And he was diagnosed with a rare disease as well. The two are completely unrelated and on opposite ends. So it's been something that I've really been passionate about and working through for quite some time. That was kind of the start. My current role, which is patient insights and strategy, really kind of was born from all of the work that I did early on with my son, with my nephew, and with just being a nurse. I started to look around, and both of them were involved in clinical studies, long-term safety studies, as well as registries, different things like that. And I felt that everything kind of focused on the science. And not a lot was focused on not just my child, but also myself having to get to site and do all of these different things that you have to do as a care partner or a parent of a child with a rare disease, and felt that, you know, the patient voice really needed to kind of be pulled through. That's really where my role was born out of. And I really got very involved with it about 15 years ago and started, you know, developing methodologies to dive deep into patients as well as their care partners and the ecosystem that kind of surrounds them, and find out, you know, what are they looking for? What do they need? And bringing it to pharma to make sure that voice of the patient and of their families was pulled through all aspects of drug development.
It's really interesting to see how you know, the work that you were forced to do as a mom and as a caregiver ended up leading to, you know, a role in this industry, right? Like, yeah, creating a position for yourself in a way where obviously, and we're going to talk about this too, you know, the status of patient advocacy today and the tools of today versus 20 years ago, because I'm sure the difference is, you know, it's unbelievable. But it's pretty amazing to see how, you know, that work that you were forced to do for yourself ended up creating almost a role, a position, and a field on itself within the industry that has been, you know, more and more adopted by, you know, everyone, understanding the importance of patient perspective and patient journey, and just creating these support groups to people, especially within the rare disease community. Generally in the industry right now, in the pharmaceutical biotech industry, what do you think is the role of patient advocacy right now, of people like you, but in general, of patient advocacy groups in today's, you know, pharma and biotech industry?
I think the role for advocacy is multi-pronged, to be honest. I think that, you know, advocacy should play a role in all of the different aspects of drug development when we're looking at it, you know, from this industry. I think that as an industry, we have an obligation to reach out to advocacy. They're the ones that really do have their finger on the pulse of what's going on with their patient populations, their constituents that are, you know, kind of signed into that. They oftentimes within advocacy are kind of the same as me, which is they came from, it was born out of a need to start finding things out. And they've all started from this aspect. So a lot of them have really deep insight into what's going on within their patient population. And I think that, you know, they have a role within policymaking, speaking to the pharmaceutical companies and making sure that they have an input into operationalizing the trial. You know, what does your protocol look like? Who the KOLs are out there? Advocacy, you know, kind of covers a lot of different roles in that. Do I feel like the pharmaceutical industry recognizes all of that? I don't know that we're there yet, but I think that that's kind of where we're moving towards and where we need to be.
If you were to tell, you know, the pharmaceutical industry how they should be thinking about using patient advocacy or partnering with patient advocates, what would you suggest to them? Like, at what stage? How would you suggest they do it? You know, when do you suggest they get you guys or patient advocates like yourself involved? Can you talk a little bit about that?
So I would say the best time to involve them is right away, early on. With that said, it's also really important to know that there's never a bad time. So maybe you're really far down that development cycle and then it comes up. That's not too late. But the earlier is, it's always better because you want to know from a pharma perspective, you want to know what's going on with that patient population. Are they looking for something else? What are they looking for? Get their input when you're starting to put your protocol together, when you're going to start to look at your endpoints, your primary and secondary endpoints. These are kind of your first line of defense. I think previously, 20 plus years ago, it was the doctors. It was the KOLs, it was the treating physicians that they were going to kind of outline some of those parameters. And I think now we're evolving into looking at it from the patient side of it. And one of the first ones that you can go to that, you know, has the finger on the patient pulse is advocacy. I'm not discounting the doctor's input in that at all in any way, shape or form. But I also feel like, you know, the advocacy groups can be one step closer to that patient population as opposed to the doctors. And that's saying that they're closer to kind of know what it is holistically that's going on with that population. You know, it's not just about symptoms and disease progression. It's all encompassing. What's going on with their lives, activities of daily living, you know, what's really a key factor for them. And I think that's one of the most important things that, you know, pharma can do is start to look at advocacy as one of those first lines to go to talk to when you're developing your product and developing your protocols. And then I think you keep them involved all the way through.
So have you seen, because I think from the evolution of patient advocacy in the last 20 years, if you will, I think there's basically two ways to look at it. One is more the old school way, which was, okay, we're going to start thinking about what the patients think when we are at the commercialization stage, right? So, mm-hmm. You know, we've done all the research, we've done all the development. Now we need to know what's important for us to be able to commercialize this product. And this is kind of the old school way, right? Or the, and now the more new school or more adopted way now to gather insights from the patient perspective and the caregiver perspective from early on to have better designs, protocols that are easier for adherence, and, you know, make the actual clinical development process easier and better. Have you seen this difference in trend, even though we may still not be there, right? But have you seen that difference in trend?
Oh, definitely. I've definitely seen an uptick on that in the past 10 years. And I don't know that it was, you know, pharma not wanting to involve advocacy. I think pharma always knew that they were there. I think they saw them in a different light. I think over the past 10 years, you know, they've kind of cast a wider net when they're looking at advocacy. It's not as scary. I think it back then it was probably a little scarier for pharma to kind of reach out and really involve advocacy until they got to that commercialization point, because we're talking about clinical trials and because we want to be really cognizant of, you know, all the rules and regulations around all of that. So I definitely think that there is an upswing, and I've seen that, you know, just in pharma reaching out and doing different projects with them, but also, you know, with the advent of a lot of these different positions, you know, you have a lot of pharma companies that are looking at directors of advocacy, where they're going to be that warm reach out to an advocacy group where they can really develop that relationship and rapport with them. I think that's really evolved over the past, you know, 5 to 7 years. And I think that's huge for our patients, as well as for advocacy and really getting kind of advocacy front and center.
How do you partner when you're with one of these companies? Let's put in this scenario that you're, you know, talking to one of the companies that want to get patient advocacy involved from early on, right?
Right.
When they reach out or when you get in touch, how do you guys partner in your personal, you know, experience at Y Prime, but maybe, you know, if you have other experience from the industry, how do you do this partnership work in terms of, you know, how, what's the relationship like? What is the exchange of knowledge? How do you support them in their clinical development process?
So I think the best thing that I tell my stakeholders and what we work through when we're going into this process is, one, we want to really establish a good relationship with the advocacy lead. Now, again, in rare disease, we're talking about some of them are so ultra rare that, you know, there may only be one or two or three people involved in advocacy for any particular, you know, therapeutic area. So it's really kind of getting a feel for what are they looking for? Like, what does the advocacy group need? And really assessing what those needs are. And I think there's been a real evolution since I've been doing this in the past 10 years to where pharma is understanding that advocacy, they may not just be looking for money. I think that that was the thought process years ago, was if we get involved with advocacy, we can only, you know, give them a certain amount of money to do what they're researching or anything like that. A lot of what the rarer groups are looking for is that collaboration. You're gathering all of this data. How can you share it? How can you help us do that? How can you help us, you know, build a website? Things like that that we've developed for some of our pharmaceutical clients to pair up with some of these smaller rare disease advocacy groups that are looking for support, not necessarily monetarily, but really, you know, how do we call all this data? You're willing to give us the data, the access to all of this information through the clinical trial. How do we call it? Or how do we start this up? How do we really, you know, look at it from a marketing perspective and different things like that, where pharma can have, they have a lot of that in-house and they can offer that up and to help the advocacy group really kind of build and make it a solid foundation for them. I think that's probably one of the key things to be able to partner with rare disease advocacy is find out what we need. What does that advocacy group need? What are they looking for? Where do they need help? And how can you support that? And not that this happens very often within rare disease, but it has, where, you know, you have a smaller startup biotech that's really specializing in one area of rare disease. And the advocacy group that is in that area is partnered up with, or it looks like, you know, they're doing a lot of work with another pharmaceutical company. And I think it's really, really important for all pharma stakeholders to understand that within advocacy, just because they're working really well with one pharmaceutical company does not in any way, shape, or form mean that you're kind of cut off from that advocacy group. Advocacy is definitely something that we're always looking for. We're looking for pharma to collaborate together, you know, for the best outcomes for ourselves and our loved ones within rare. So I think, you know, that assumption, don't let that stop you in the pharmaceutical industry just because you see in one area they're kind of, they've established a relationship or they're putting together a community and they're being supported by one pharma company. A, we want as many involved as possible in order to help us and help our loved ones. But we also are kind of desperate for pharma to come together and share information and collaborate for the betterment of our disease process.
And I think that's important. Maybe this, you know, rings a bell with people on the audience listening to our conversation right now, because I'm sure that's something that people have experienced before, where they look at a patient advocacy group, they see a big pharma name, them being a, maybe a smaller biotech company, and they're like, oh, okay, I'm out, because they're already partnering with, you know, this big company. And so I think that you saying like, look, what we're doing here is for our loved ones, our kids, our, you know, brothers, sisters, mom, dad, that have a rare disease or you know, a disease that it's important for mm-hmm. a certain patient advocacy group. It doesn't matter the pharma company, big, small, biotech, we want to be as inclusive as possible, have everyone together, right, working towards finding, you know, a cure or a therapy. Right. to this disease. I think that's really important. I wanted to shift the conversation a little bit from more of like an industry focus to a personal focus to rare disease, patient advocacy, the specifics on how patient advocacy works. And I'm really interested in seeing how it works, how the ecosystem has evolved in the last few years, the role of social media, the role of being able to pretty much talk to anyone at any time, but also the pros of that, but also the cons, the spreading of misinformation maybe, or you know how difficult it is to filter what information you should follow or what information you shouldn't. So I know this is a lot and I'm going to try to walk us through some of these topics. But first of all, I think it would be great to get your perspective on how do you work with patients and families as a kind of like a leader in the patient advocacy community? How do you work today with these people as a patient advocate?
So from mom perspective and being very involved in my son's rare advocacy and being his patient advocate and helping others looks a little bit different than my day job, I guess, my real job on the other side. That's more of, you know, trying to connect the patients within the advocacy groups with information that they need or connect them with different resources that they're looking for, you know, when it comes to my advocacy hat for my son or my nephew or their family members or anything. It's really looking for what their needs are and culling all the information out to really get them what they're looking for. You know, on the flip side, in my day job and what I try to do is really dive deep for the patients and talk to them. You know, seek out the patients, the caregivers, sit down and have really in-depth, robust one-on-one conversations with them to be able to really get to the heart of what's going on with them and then bring it back to my pharmaceutical clients and present it from the patient's voice. So I like to describe it as kind of taking my clientele and giving them a deep dive empathetically, putting them in the patient's shoes. From what I know from interviewing these patients and talking to the advocacy groups. So I think that's on that pharma end of it, this clinical side of it, that's how I'm implementing it from a business side of it for pharma. And then from the personal side of it, it's implementing it. It's really finding the tools, connecting my people within my advocacy groups with what they need, searching out clinical trials. Let's call a spade, anybody that's been out there searching for clinical trials. It is not an easy task. It is an incredibly confusing undertaking and simplifying it for those individuals. And then, you know, telling pharma they have to simplify it for their patient populations as well.
It's really challenging for someone, I guess, outside of the, you know, patient advocacy ecosystem and understanding what you guys do to really even probably imagine how those interactions, those conversations work with pharma or with families, patients, caregivers, because it's an area that it's just almost a behind the scenes for people working on actively on research, right? People writing protocols or monitoring studies or putting strategies to develop the clinical trials. So I think it's an area that's extremely important because in the end, the core foundation of everything are the patients. Right. But, you know, sometimes the people developing those therapies and those treatments are quite away, right? Quite separated from those patients and the reality of those patients.
Right. And I think that's such an important point to make because I feel like when you're developing the protocols and you know, being on the advocacy side and being a parent that's involved in something like this, with if I took my other hat off, say, from our perspective, we're looking at some of these protocols or looking at some of the asks and thinking, what? As a parent and as somebody that's involved, you get a little bit upset and everything like that. And I think what's really, really important for not only pharma to recognize, but for advocacy and the patients and the families to recognize is the people that are putting these protocols together, while we might take a step back and look at it and scratch our heads, I think they're in it for the right reasons. You know, it's just that we're in it over here for this reason. They're on the other side in it for a completely different reason, but still have our best interest and the want to make things better for our patient population. It's just that they don't have a lot of exposure to what's going on with that patient. And it's very easy when you're in that realm of, you know, developing that protocol and you want the data, you want the scientific, that's all you can really think about. And what I think is so important and what I try to do for all of my clients is bring that empathy to them, bring it to them so that then they do. I've never sat with any of my client stakeholders and done a report out where people were not in the room getting it, sitting there and saying, yes, like I get it now. It's just, you know, everybody needs to understand that everybody has a job to do. And sometimes on that scientific end from the clinical side, it's not that they don't care. It's they're myopically thinking of the scientific. And that's kind of what we want them to do. We just want to make sure they have that other aspect. They don't know what they don't know until we bring it to them.
And as a scientist myself, I can see how you as a scientist, them as a scientist, focus on what you were saying, right? The quality of the data, the endpoints, what you need to check as a box to be able to develop the therapy. And I'm sure that more often than not, those discrepancies between what's doable or not in real life are not that big. It's just things, right? Small, simple things that is just like an aha for the scientific part that, oh, I didn't even think that this would be a burden, but right, it clearly is now that you as a mom are telling me that maybe bringing your kid 4 times a week, you know, for 4 visits is crazy. And I can simplify it to 2 visits. Maybe that makes the world of a difference to you. And I didn't think about it. And I can actually be as good scientifically as I was, you know, just simplifying the number of visits. This is an example, but I'm sure that more often than not, the things to change or to adjust are relatively small compared to the benefit that they bring to you as a patient or to the patients, you know, from their patient journey perspective.
Right. They are. And I think it's really important for those of us on this end as, you know, a patient and a caretaker and all of that to really understand that, you know, they are trying to really help and they're trying to get to the bottom of things from a scientific perspective. And we just need to open their eyes a little bit to what else is going on for that entirety of the ecosystem around that patient.
Yeah. And I think that's important too, because I think it's really important to validate all these thoughts with you guys, because even when you think you're doing something for the patient interest, you may not knowingly do actually something that patients are not interested in.
Right.
Like I think maybe you and I have discussed this in the past, but I remember having a conversation around at-home visits.
Yes.
And everyone was like, oh, I'm sure everyone loves at-home visits.
Right.
And I don't know if it was with you or someone else, but they were like, no, home for my kid with it's this safe disease is like their safe space.
Yes.
And if someone comes home, my kid's going to freak out. And I'd rather spend 4 hours getting them ready and going to the hospital than have something coming home. And like, as a scientist, and you talk to a pharma company, they would be like, oh, no, for sure, we're doing great by mobilizing the entire study to their home. What's better than that? And then from the patient perspective, you realize, oh, no, this is just not going to work. It's not what we need.
Right. And I think that is probably the best classic example that I could come up with, because we did have that conversation. And it was, you would think, you know, the pharma company was doing everything right. They thought, this is definitely a pediatric population, very rare. Majority are non-mobile, vented. You know, it's a lot to get that child to a site. You know, there's a lot that goes into that when you have a child that's vent dependent, that's wheelchair bound, things like that. And they really did go into it with the best of intentions. And once we talked to the patient population, we realized that even the best intentions wasn't going to work for them. It might have worked in another patient population, but for them, it was, you know, no. Like no white, it's almost like white coat syndrome, and I don't want it in the house. Like, let it be the safe space. And that's a classic example of the pharma company wanting to do everything right. And the patient population saying, I love the fact that you're trying this, but here's why we don't want it.
And I think this is a great example on why, for all the folks out there from the pharma biotech side, do not hesitate to reach out to patient advocacy groups or, you know, people like Kelly, because even when you think you're doing the right thing, you may be missing some key points that, you know, are just just not going to work. So one thing that I believe it's obvious for any field pretty much nowadays, but I think has an extremely big meaning in patient advocacy is obviously the internet and social media. So I can even imagine being a mom or a dad of a kid with rare disease or having, you know, a rare disease myself, trying to research symptoms, trying to research, you know, doctors, trying to research without the internet. So I think internet opened the doors for people doing their own research, trying to figure out a lot of things that were impossible 20, 25 years ago. And then I think social media helped them get together. You know, someone in Florida and someone in Washington State having the two kids with the same symptoms now can very easily be connected. 15 years ago, pre-Facebook, it was pretty much impossible, right? Some blocks here and there, but it was probably much, much more difficult than now. It would be really interesting to learn from you and your perspective on how much the internet has helped people doing their own research. I'm sure moms and dads out there are incredible at doing their own research. And then how much has social media empowered these people to create their little communities and to just be able to support one another and be more visible to pharma companies?
Yeah, so great question and definitely something that is just ever evolving. Let's attack it in two parts. First, internet and searching and everything else. With being able to search, I think it's much better. It's done more good than harm, but it is a double-edged sword. I mean, I think that anybody looking at that would agree because there is misinformation out there. And you can get the Dr. Google, WebMD, you know, scary heebie-jeebies and think, you know, that everything's coming at you. So that is kind of a negative in that sense. But I think the positives far outweigh that because the ability to search and the ability to inform yourself. And I don't want to say weaponized because it's a really negative word, but it kind of is. You get all of the information sort of like you have an arsenal of information. It really helps you develop what are the questions that I need to ask? Like, what am I looking at? And you're looking at comorbidities and doctors that are out there. And it also allows you to see, you know, outside of your smaller bubble and what's going on overseas. Like, what are patients doing over there? I think that it has really helped. I think that, you know, it's something that pharma is coming to grips with. They're dealing with much, much more educated patient consumers. They're going to ask a lot of questions. They're not going to make decisions in the snap anymore. You know, 25 years ago, when I brought my son to the doctors, the doctor told us what to do. We did it. I still did some research, but we did it. I just happened to be in the medical field, so I did a little more research. But nowadays, you know, you're constantly gathering information, and then you're taking that information, and then you're going online, and you're testing against it. So I think it has really opened up for parents and family members and patients of rare disease to be able to search out things and get the information much quicker than they would have been able to before. I actually think it is starting to help with a decreased time from symptom to actual diagnosis. You know, back in the day, it took forever to get diagnosed with some rare diseases. It would just take such a long time. I think with the advent of, you know, the internet, that's much better. Now, from a social media and connections and everything else, I think it has really allowed the rare disease communities overall to feel much more connected with each other. You know, 25, 30 years ago, you felt like you were on an island. You didn't know that there was anyone else in the entire world that could ever have gone through what you've gone through, the future that you could be staring down the barrel at. So I think that has really increased. Patient communities have really become that secondary advocacy. For some therapeutic areas, it is the advocacy group.
I was going to say, I imagine that some things that are smaller or ultra rare, probably the Facebook group is the only thing out there.
Is their advocacy group, and they are connected all over the place, and they are really making educated patients that are finding out, you know, they're talking to someone in Europe. It brings me back to triple negative breast cancer, where the majority of those patients were plugged into these community groups that were global, and they're finding out, you know, what are you doing in Germany? How are they treating it? They're taking that information and they were bringing it back to their physicians and saying, I want this. I want to try this. They're telling me about this clinical trial. It has really opened up that world of being able to really advocate for yourself or for your loved one. And it's arming you with a lot more information than you were getting previously. Is it dangerous sometimes? Yes. But I do think that some of these community groups out there, and I'm involved in a lot of them, are really highly on alert. They're moderating. They're paying attention to everything that's being said. If there's anything that goes in there that is even questionable data or questionable information, it's immediately being, you know, stopped and pulled out. At least that's been my experience so far. I think it's, you know, it's an incredible thing, and it's educating our patients and family members much more so. But, you know, it's a double-edged sword probably for pharma and the patients or and the doctors, because, you know, bad things travel just as fast too.
Yeah, but I think obviously, you know, I can see how in some scenarios, you know, there may be even a little bit of maybe not pushback, but it must be uncomfortable for doctors or physicians, right, to say, oh, like they don't come to me anymore to ask these questions. They go on to their Facebook group. But, you know, that's the reality of today's age, right? And you're able to connect very easily with peers that are going through the same things you're going. And yes, they may not have that scientific expertise or medical expertise, but they do know how you feel. They do know your issues, the problems that you're dealing with every day, right? And I think that that's also very powerful and very valuable for those people with rare disease or moms, dads, caregivers. And I think that, as you were saying, right, I think the pros outweigh the cons in this scenario. Yes, I'm sure there's, you know, there's a lot of information that has to be filtered out, especially in Dr. Google, as you were saying. But I think that in these little groups, communities, people, for the most part, do a very good job on just trying to be valuable for one another.
It's important to know and remember that while we're evolving as patient groups and everything else into this technology, there are some doctors on the other side that it probably could be a little bit uncomfortable for. But, you know, the new generations of doctors that are coming out are in this generation. They're in this technology, so they get it. And they're looking at that more globally and understanding it a little bit better. So I think as we are evolving and getting our information there, so is the medical community, as well as the pharmaceutical communities that are, you know, the next generations are taking over and they're recognizing it and expanding it out.
And I think that's a really good point, because for some reason, usually the people that are early adopters of new technology are usually the people that are not the most established on the field. But now you see a lot of really good, solid, recognized, world-renowned doctors, physicians, dermatologists, the rare disease, a lot of people posting on Instagram, making stories, making videos, having a podcast, having a show, having a blog. And that just validates that social media and internet is not only bad things, or it's not only misinformation. There is a lot of really good content, good support. And you just need to be aware that, you know, you have to be conscious of the information that you're taking from the internet and that you're giving to the internet. So both ways, right? To create a better source for everyone. I've never been to one of these groups and never tried to get into one of these communities, right? I'm also imagine that as any other group, they try to protect themselves a little bit from the outside, right? Mm-hmm. So if I'm someone that wants to get in touch with a group, whether it's I'm from a pharma company, a biotech company, I'm a physician that want to help, I'm, you know, whoever that wants to get involved with one of these groups on social media, what would you recommend them do to be able to connect to the right person, to be able to not seen as a threat or as an outsider to that group? Like, what do you recommend people do to get in touch with these groups?
I'm going to be a straight shooter on this one. I think most of these community leaders of these community groups are super gun shy about having pharma, anyone from pharma in it. it's been something that I've navigated for the past 7 years now, 7 to 10 years. It's something that's hard to navigate. You have to have the best of intentions. You have to have multiple conversations with, you know, some of these community leaders that hold the key to, you know, allowing you into that community group, because they want it to be a safe space for the patients, for them to be able to vent. And there's a lot of times, you know, there's name brands that are being discussed either on a positive or a negative. They don't want it to be used in any way. So I have always kind of advocated that if pharma wants to do it and get a feel for it, they probably want to do it through somebody that's very plugged into advocacy, somebody that has that mindset, or, you know, a third party. Like, I would say for the majority of my stakeholders over the past 7 years, I've been, or my team has been the one developing the relationship with the community leaders that have then led us into the site, because they understand that from my perspective, we don't talk anything specific. We don't talk about any pharmaceutical companies, any specific drugs, any specific anything. We really explain that we're there as a genuine observer so that we can really understand how to empathetically put together this patient persona for the pharmaceutical company. I'm not saying that it's impossible for a pharmaceutical company to do that, but I do believe that, you know, the majority of the community leaders out there feel that it will in some way taint the group or sway it or something like that. So it might be a little bit more difficult. There might be a lot more discussions that pharma might need to have, or they might want to utilize a third party because they don't have a stake in the game. They just want to know about the patients. How they get about that should be the best way for the patient, not for the pharma company.
Yeah, I know. And that makes a lot of sense. And I can see that, because I think sometimes, you know, there's still that perception of some of these companies just wanting to extract from the patient mm-hmm. advocacy instead of just giving to. And I think it's both ways, right? Obviously, they want to use the information and the advice, but in the end is to just give them with ultimately the most valuable thing, which is a therapy or you know, or a treatment. So I think that it's a win-win situation. But sometimes, just because obviously also the past experiences, probably, I guess initial communication can be a little challenging. I wanted also to, your experience in all of this, right? From the research pre-internet to the research during internet to the use of social media to, I think it's amazing to see how, you know, involved you've been in all ends of the spectrum. I was curious to, and I think this would be a good way to, you know, start as we approach the end of this conversation. I'm sure you went through a long, you know, period of trying to figure out a lot of things, right? With your child and, mm-hmm. And the diagnoses and the symptoms and how to navigate it and find doctors, etc. I'm thinking, I'm sure still nowadays, you know, there is a lot of families. There is a mom out there and a dad out there that have been to 20 different doctors still trying to figure out, what does my kid have? You know, how do I get in touch with someone that may help me navigate this? Mm-hmm. So I think it would be really interesting for anyone out there that's listening from that mom, dad, brother, sister perspective that are right now going through this, right? If you could explain a little bit of what was your journey like to find diagnosis, and then what would you recommend them do? You know, right now they're probably in this like kind of lost stage. Like, I'm going from doctor to doctor. No one can seem to figure out what's going on. Like, what do I do? Who do I get in touch with? You know, if you could explain a little bit of your journey and just giving them a little bit of advice on what to do, I think that would be really, really useful for some people out there.
I think it's probably different for every person. I think it's always somewhat difficult to navigate the journey of getting a diagnosis that is rare. I would say my biggest advice to family members, parents, anyone out there that's in the process of this is, I think everybody that's going through it would probably agree, in your gut, you know something's not right. So you're going to get a lot of no's, or I don't know, or maybe you're just being an overactive mom, you know, you're a new mom, because he was my first, you know, you're a new mom and blah, blah. You go through a lot of self-doubt, self-questioning. Don't do it. Don't do it. I understand it. I've been there. Don't do it. You know what you know. Stay the course. And if you're not getting answers in one place, go to the next place. I can't say what that place is because it might be looking something up. It might be the doctor. It might be a nurse practitioner. It could be anything, but don't give up. It is long and it is arduous. I understand that. And I feel your pain, but don't give up. I think, you know, your intuition knows and you keep fighting because you are your own advocate as well as your loved one's advocate. So never give up. Never let anyone diminish your voice or what you're telling them about what's going on. And I would say to pharma on the other side and physicians and clinical sites and different things like that, I always in 10 years as I've been presenting, always ended with this quote from Maya Angelou, which is, you know, people are going to forget what you say and people are going to forget what you do. And every time I say it, I cry, but they're never, ever going to forget how you made them feel in those moments. And those bad experiences, they stay with you. He's going to be 26 years old. I remember the bad experiences at, you know, a year old, at whatever age it was, I remember them and I carry them. I also will remember the ones that touched my heart and made me feel not crazy and feel good about what was going on. So don't give up. And you'll find your answer, but it's not going to be easy, but you'll get through it.
You know, I also would like to encourage from here everyone that's dealing with that to reach out to people like you. You can see how passionate and how emotional you get when remembering the journey you had to navigate, and you're still navigating, but you know, the early stage, mm-hmm. which is probably the most difficult one and the most, you feel alone, you feel misunderstood, you feel almost like you're losing it, or they, you know, sometimes you feel, am I just crazy? And then there's actually nothing happening here.
Yeah.
So I would encourage everyone to reach out to people in groups, to people like Kelly, you know, in patient advocacy groups, even if it may be a completely different disease than what your kid or your loved one may end up being diagnosed, but the experience of navigating that is going to be probably quite similar, right? On feeling
yeah.
alone, on
the
doubt.
Loneliness.
On self-doubt, yes. On the challenges of finding the diagnosis. So I just want to encourage everyone to, you know, do not hesitate. People would love to help you so you don't have
yes.
to go through what they did go through. So please reach out.
Don't sit in the silence. The silence can be deafening when you're waiting for answers and you have none. Don't sit in it. Reach out.
All right. Well, so I think I wanted to...
Now you wouldn't cry.
No. And I think, I think, Kelly, this is just a beautiful way to wrap up this conversation, because I do think that, you know, you have an amazing background. You have a lot of experience to bring to the table from both the personal and the professional side. But I think that if there's something that overpowers everything here, is the passion that you show when working on this, because obviously it's been your life, right, for the last 20 plus
yeah.
years. And I think that that's what we find, at least from my perspective, right? Like, you do find that people, especially in rare disease, are often more involved, passionate, committed, dedicated to the research than everyone else. Obviously everyone is, but
yeah.
rare disease is something special because
yeah,
there's
yeah.
a lot of pushing and paving first trails. There's a lot of building things for the first time. There's a lot of discovering that you do for the first time. And I think that it's a little special area within clinical development, within drug development. So, and I think you know, your passion shows it perfectly. I want to spend 30 seconds saying that it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm sure that the audience will agree that you're obviously a great patient advocate. For the sound of it, an amazing mom that has fought a lot, you know, for your kid and for helping others, which is even more amazing. And so it's been an honor to have you here. You know, we wish you and your family the best going forward, and we hope to, you know, have you as a continued partner and someone to discuss clinical research and rare disease research, because it's truly an honor.
Well, I just want to say thank you so much. I love being able to talk about this, if nobody can tell. It's kind of my baby, but I absolutely love being involved in this. I think what you're doing with this podcast is absolutely amazing, kind of bringing it to the larger group and to the masses. And I really, really appreciate being able to not only have this opportunity to talk with you, but also to, you know, work with you and Bio Rossi on a lot of the exciting and interesting things that you all are doing there. So I would say anyone that wants has any questions or needs help with anything, please do not hesitate to reach out to me. I'm always available. Always.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Kelly. Again, we appreciate it. We may have a part two of this series with you. So great. Stay tuned, everyone. I'm Mark Gass. I've been today's host for this episode of Few and Far Between, Conversations about Rare Disease Research. Hope you all have enjoyed this episode. We'll see you in the next one. Thank you very much for listening.
Thanks.
Okay, that wraps it up for this week. If you enjoyed this podcast or have suggestions for future episodes and how we can make it better, please get in touch with us. You can email us at fewandfarbetween@biorossi.com or contact us on our website at biorossi.com. You can also leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Thanks again.